High fly ball into right field. She is gone. In a year that has been so improbable, the impossible has happened. This one by Mattingly. Oh!
Welcome to another episode of Table Setters Call, covering all things Major League Baseball. As always, I'm Steve, joined by co-host Devin on a beautiful, beautiful Tuesday evening. What's up, dude?
Nothing much, man. Same as always, Tuesday nights. Talk a little baseball, watch a little baseball. Looking forward to it.
So we're covering all things in the wide world of baseball here, including, of course, Major League Baseball, some prospect talk. But getting into some of the shilling and supporting the show, you guys can follow us on Instagram at Table Setters Pod on IG. Also at Table Setters Pod on the Twitter machine as well. Devin running both those social media accounts with ease, doing a lot of great stuff, posting some great reels. So please interact on there. I think we're up to like 66 followers. If you can guys get us above 100 this weekend, that'd be a blessing. Let's do it.
Yeah, let's get to that mark. That's a nice mark to set.
So we have a lot to get into. So we're not going to really, do a lot of shilling about the top of the show. Let's get right into our opening say here and what caught our eye this week. All right, Devin, right to the races here. We're, squaring around the first pitch here, and I'll let you lead the way with what caught your eye so far this week.
Yeah, so an interesting week. I felt like this week was more about the baseball being played on the field. No one, big headline-grabbing story, like in some of the past weeks, whether it be the Shohei gambling stuff or obviously the elbow injuries and then the update to the Shohei story recently. It's just a bunch of different baseball stories for the most part. And the one that caught my eye is Michael Busch. There may be some people that weren't even very familiar with that name up until a few days ago, but he is a Chicago Cub. He has hit a home run in 5 games in a row. They acquired him from the Dodgers in the offseason, kind of a quiet deal. Busch was a guy for the Dodgers, it's just a Dodger issue, a good problem to have, where they have so many talented players and not enough spots for them. So they traded him away for 2 very good prospects from the Cubs. And the Cubs are making the best of it with this guy. This guy always tore it up in AAA and then just didn't get enough time in the majors to really see what he could do. So he's getting his time now. He's batting .327 with 12 RBIs, .731 slugging percentage. And he is the first rookie to homer in 5 consecutive games since Bobby Dalbec back in 2000. It's the longest streak by a Cub since 1900, which is pretty crazy. And no rookie has ever homered in 6 straight games. So he's got a chance to be the first. They play the Diamondbacks tonight, 9:40 start. It's currently 9:05. So we do not have an update for you there, but who knows? Maybe by the end of the show, we'll pop one out in his first at bat.
Doesn't it feel like Michael Busch is everything that a cult hero in the north side of Chicago would be? He feels like that type of player that you see a lot of those jerseys popping up in the summer, sitting in the bleachers. I don't know, something about him. And good for Michael Busch, as you said, excess on the Dodgers side. Sometimes when you're trimming the fat on their end, another man's trash is another man's potpourri, as a great man, the Grinch, used to say. But man, it's an embarrassment of riches with the Dodgers. So sometimes you have to cut some good players. And the Cubs have been a surprise so far. I mean, 10-6 right now going into tonight. They've been fun. Those fans are going to show up to the ballpark, have a good time once, warm weather comes around. But I mean, they seem like they're an exciting team. Are they going to win the World Series? Hell no, but they're going to be a fun watch for the rest of the year. And Michael Busch is just another elaborate story they can add to it.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what his stat line is at the end of the year. If he can, get a full season in here. Obviously, pitchers make adjustments to these younger guys that they don't have a book on yet. But if you could look at his minor league stats, they're pretty gaudy. So who knows? Maybe he could pop 30 out this year. That'd be quite a rookie season.
So we'll be recording 40 minutes in, so we'll probably get to see his first at bat here live on the air. But as far as catching my eye, we got another blue and red team here. The Rangers have announced this morning that top pitching prospect Jack Leiter will have his contract selected to the major league roster and make his big league debut this Thursday. So 2 days from now, you're listening Wednesday morning, that's tomorrow, against the mighty Detroit Tigers. So We've been talking about it. We even posted a reel on our social media at Table Setters Pod on Instagram. I'm sure it was shared on Twitter as well. Jack Leiter making his way to the big leagues. He is the fourth Leiter to reach the majors, and he hasn't had straightforward path to the show despite considerable effort and prospect pedigree. We all know how touted he was out of Vanderbilt. We knew how great he was, and then he struggled to get there, but we're going to see him on the big stage, and maybe there's not as much hype as there would have been if he came in swinging from the beginning, but still it's exciting to see Jack Leiter get a taste of the big league show.
Yeah. We had talked about him, you know, just a couple weeks ago about how he had gotten off to a better start in AAA. He had to repeat AA last year, and his main issue was control. And we kind of both were saying, listen, if this kid gets his control together, he's a talented pitcher there. So who knows what'll do. And again, kind of like we said with Wyatt Langford, he's going to a great spot with Bruce Bochy as his manager, a World Series champion team surrounded by guys that are, you know, just good players. And eventually, like we mentioned, he'll be surrounded by some really legendary pitchers as far as Max Scherzer coming back in May, eventually Jacob DeGrom. Nate Eovaldi is healthy. He's there, on and on and on. So I'm pulling for him. I don't know what the plan as far as how long he'll stick, if this is just a cup of coffee or if he does well, if they'll keep him here, because they also just had Michael Lorenzen start a game. Cody Bradford has been a nice surprise for them. He's been very, very good. So I wonder how they'll juggle this all now. But Leiter, if you haven't seen him, a much different pitcher than his dad. If you're familiar with Al Leiter, obviously Al was a lefty. His son is not, he's a righty, and it's just a different repertoire, but, hopefully he lights it up out there. He's looked good in his first three starts in AAA. Definitely got up this year faster than we anticipated. I was thinking maybe mid season if he was doing really well, but here we go.
So hopefully we find some middle ground. Of course, if you guys are familiar with his draft pedigree coming out of Vanderbilt, he struck out 41% of his opponents in two seasons before being drafted. And he had a little bit of trouble with the command as soon as he got to AA, and then it got really pretty bad at the end there. Leiter was walking more than 13% of the batters and posted an ERA north of 5 in his first two seasons at the AA level. But right now, since he's in AAA, this season in 14 and a third, he's punched out 25 of 57 batters, which is good for 43.9%, walked only 3. It's written only 11 hits. So now is the time as ever. He'll turn 24 in only 3 days past his call-up date, so an early birthday present for Jack Leiter. Like I mentioned before, second-generation talent. He's the son of, as you mentioned before, Al Leiter, you know, nephew of 11-year MLB veteran Mark Leiter, and the cousin of Cubs setup man Mark Leiter Jr. So this is a family that has lineage in the MLB, and this dude came out, I would say, more touted than any of them, but he took a weird roundabout path because it seemed like he was streamlined. The Rangers are going to have him up there, contribute at the big league level right out of college, but wasn't the case. We saw the divide from college to what happened in the major leagues. There was something missing there. And you and I had the conversation on the first episode about streamlining that path, about having major league ready players out of the draft, whether it be, you know, late in high school or following college, whatever it may be. There was a divide for Jack Leiter, and whatever it was a command, was maybe some of the tells were there in the beginning, but we're starting to see the strikeout numbers, which has to be exciting for the Texas Rangers.
Yeah, I mean, guys are more patient once you get to a certain level, because it's a lot about, you know, recognizing pitches. Whereas college, I'll be honest, I've gone back in the last day or two and watched some of his highlights at Vanderbilt, and he was getting some strike calls that looked pretty significantly off the plate, almost a la like Greg Maddux and Tom Glavine in the 90s when they would get like 3 to 4 inches off the plate. Consistently, that's what it looked like. So a different game, man. And you know, it's crazy because some of these guys are coming up so fast, and we're acting like, you know, 2 years or 2.5 years in the minors is a long time, but years ago I feel like that was almost par for the course. So we'll see. I'm excited to watch him. Seems like a good kid, good head on his shoulders, has the lighter name. Should be fun.
Yeah, and as I said before, if he can get the walk rate down and keep it a consistent level like we're seeing in AAA, I think he'll be fine. The strikeouts have to leave fans enamored with the prospect of him being up there as a contributor at the big league level. And like you said, we'll see. It's appointment watching for Thursday. I'm going to pull up the game here. I think it is a 7 o'clock start, but I want to just make sure of it. That's a 1:10 start, and he's going against Kenta Maeda on the road too. So that's a big start for Jack Leiter here, as we're going to see the pedigree of a guy who's been highly touted. I mean, we saw some debuts here with some rookies, and maybe Jack Leiter's fallen down the list a bit, and recency bias has taken us down a path of maybe not being as excited. But when you see the stuff, you have to at least be excited. Like you said, watch some of the highlights from Vanderbilt. The raw talent is there, so hopefully he can put it together and be the dominant Jack Leiter that he was drafted in the first round for.
Yeah, and not a bad idea to get him up here. I think a lot of teams nowadays like a pitcher to debut on the road. In a way, I think it takes a little pressure off than you know, trying to impress your home crowd. Detroit's not a bad pitcher ballpark. You know, it's not a hitter's ballpark. It's not necessarily the greatest pitcher's ballpark anymore. I think they messed with the fences over the years, but kind of in the middle. And the Tigers lineup, I mean, the Tigers are improved, but their offense is not exactly tearing it up. So I think it's a good idea. Try to get him while he's hot down there and make the best of it.
With that being said, let's get to the meat of the order and talk about some early contenders and some pretenders. All right, so we have a lot of stuff to cover in the meat of the order here. And of course, we have, you know, a couple weeks ahead of us. We know a little bit about the teams that we've seen here, and there are some that we know from the beginning will be contenders. There are some that we can see through. They're like see-through translucent glass. They are pretenders. But I'll let you start, Devin, with your pretender and why you believe that they are not going to be contending this time in, let's just say, 5-6 weeks.
So for me, there was a few choices here, but the Angels are the ones that jump out. And it's just because of the history the last however many years. You know, we've talked a decent amount in the first four episodes about Mike Trout and how we feel like, you know, a lot of his talent and his time in the majors has unfortunately been wasted on a team that never seems to be able to put it together and make the playoffs. We had posted a reel maybe about a week ago of Mike Trout's, this is hard to believe, but Mike Trout's only postseason career hit, which was a home run, but in a series that they got quickly swept by the Royals in 2014. All that recency and then having Shohei Ohtani and Trout and, you know, signing, you know, Anthony Rendon, who hasn't worked out. It seems like every big free agent other than Shohei has just never worked out. You could go way back and talk about Josh Hamilton. We could talk about Albert Pujols not being the guy he was as a Cardinal, on and on and on and on. Listen, the run differential is still -5. So despite the winning record, if you look at the run differential, which is usually pretty telling in the long run, I think there's some holes there. Now, listen, if the lineup can stay healthy, and I'm talking mainly about guys like Trout, obviously, and Taylor Ward, who's gotten off to a sizzling start, and to be honest, always seems to get off to a sizzling start, and it just seems like something eventually happens. But if some of the main cogs on offense can stay healthy, I don't think the offense is the worst thing I've seen. I am less trustworthy of the pitching staff. Their team ERA is 4.69, which is good for 24th in the majors. And that's with Reed Detmers. If you haven't seen what Reed Detmers has done his first bunch of times out, he's been incredible. It looks like he's put it all together. He's 3-0 with a 1.04 ERA and a 0.81 whip. The fact that one of your starters is doing that well and your ERA is still 24th in the majors, and Tyler Anderson's been pretty good as well. Patrick Sandoval, other than his first start, hasn't been terrible. So I don't know much about the bullpen. I think that's probably a pretty big weakness for them. I just don't trust him. I like Ron Washington a lot. He almost makes me want to believe it. Seeing Trout hit home runs and steal some bases now again, it's like I'm pulling for them. But if I have to label a pretender, it's them. And then to go to the other side, the contender, I think it's the Royals for me right now. As far as a team that is, the record is surprising in a positive way and someone that we think can keep it going, I think it's them. Obviously a very solid start, a +39 run differential going in tonight. That is significant, and it's the best in the entire league. That's a big deal. I know, you know, it's early, it's April, but that's a big deal. I think they have a nice mix of youth and vets now. Whereas last year it was mostly young guys that they really thought were just going to take the next step. Michael Wacha and Seth Lugo have been great additions as veteran pitchers. Obviously, Cole Reagans is the budding superstar there, and he's looked every bit of what we expected this year. Brady Singer, I think, added a new pitch this year and has looked better. I'm not going to hold my breath as far as that continuing because he's burned us a few times. And then the bullpen is, in my opinion, the biggest concern or shortcoming, which I would worry that that could kind of, you know, send them tumbling a little bit. And here's the elephant in the room is Bobby Witt Jr. This guy, he may in a year or so be the face of this league, like the best player in the league. There's a lot of competition for that moniker, but it might be him, man. If you watch it, as a Met fan, I got to watch him a little closer this week or this weekend in that series, and he's fun to watch. He didn't even have the greatest series in the world against them, but he's incredible. He can do everything. Their team ERA is 2.86, which is second in the major leagues. 729 team OPS, which is 11th best. And it's a division that can be had as well. I know the Guardians have gotten off to a great start as well, but that division can be had. So I would not be shocked to see them kind of surprise everybody and pull that division out. So second team ERA in the league and the best run differential. You got to put some stock in that.
For the sake of conversation, I picked a different contender, but I do want to throw some flowers at the feet of the Royals of what they've done so far, especially they're at the tail end of a 106 loss season the year before. So let's not forget that. Everyone expected that they would improve. And of course, it's, you know, we're sitting here, you know, 17 games into the season. So let's not say they won the World Series yet. But for them to be improving at the level here, like you mentioned before, what we're seeing from Bobby Witt Jr., but also Nelson Velasquez, Salvador Perez, who didn't hit the IL, but he's day to day with, you know, an injury right now. It doesn't seem like he's going to do some time here. Some historical preference for you to hear about this is an MLB article posted last October. 13 teams in MLB's divisional era since 1969 improved by at least 27 wins in a single season, none of which gained more than 35 wins. So if the Royals were to win 92 games or more this year, it'd be a history-making transformation from year to year. So a lot of teams have come and gone that have, you know, we've seen teams take the next step, take a huge step. This would be the biggest jump. And I'm not sitting here saying they're going to win 92 games, but the way they're playing now, and especially too, the one other thing I want to say is odds makers. If you're looking at some of the odds about them winning the AL Central, they went from plus 550 to win the AL Central and plus 280 to make the playoffs. You know, and that's at some point they're plus 9,000 to win the World Series. And that's trending in a different direction at this point. So if you follow the odds makers, they usually have the scent on something that's legit. I believe in the Royals here. I think especially in that division where it's up for grabs, do you trust the Twins? Do you trust the Tigers? Do you trust, you know, the Guardians? Other than that, I mean, it's up for grabs for anybody. And if it's going to be a team, why not be with the most explosive player in baseball right now with Bobby Witt Jr.? Because everyone was expecting him, similar to the Royals, to take the next step. But this step we're seeing from him, this is superstar face of the league type of stuff we're seeing from Bobby Witt. And it's goddamn exciting. So, but Sally Perez, I mean, let's not forget about this. This is an older catcher who's done a lot of time behind the plate. You know, this dude, you know, he's kind of hitting into the MVP candidate level that he was in 2020, 2021. And then MJ Melendez is seeing the ball better than ever. So, like, this is a team that kind of feels like the pieces are falling together. And again, don't want to be too, you know, filled with hyperbole about the Kansas City Royals. But, you know, the pitching right now, as you mentioned before, some of those names, it's been exquisite right now. 9 quality starts already in the books early this season. So it's pretty exciting to see what's going on in Kansas City. And they're a fun team to root for.
Absolutely. I mean, you really can't poke that many holes in them right now. Steve, just quickly, when you're talking, I'm getting a lot of buzzing on like with every word you speak. So I'm not sure if it's on my end. I don't hear it when I speak. So I don't know if we want to test it out. I don't know if that's being recorded or not.
I don't believe it's on my end at all. It might be a wire issue on your end. I think for mine, I would usually pick it up as well.
All right. Let me see if I hold on.
So while you're trying to fix that, I'll talk about my pretender here because the Boston Red Sox have been kind of a surprise. You and I talked about it before, just what the Boston Red Sox were going to be this year. You were more high on them than I was. They finished dead last in the AL East last year, and the pitching was an issue. And it feels like the pitching got worse. I mean, they allowed 1,563 runs between 2022, 2023, while the next worst staff in the AL East was Baltimore at 1,366. And that's a big divide. And then they traded away Chris Sale, John Schreiber. All signs pointed towards the pitching getting worse. Felt like they should have been horrible, but they started 7-3 during a 10-game road trip against AL West teams. They're surprising people. Everyone's excited. You see a buzz in Boston. They love their sports teams. Now they lost Nick Pivetta to an elbow strain. They're optimistic that it's going to be minimal. This is all smoke and mirrors to me, and this is not just a Yankee hater sitting here talking about it. I really believe that this is not going to be sustainable. It could be fun. I mean, they did weather a storm here with Baltimore. They played them tough. They had to face them early in the year. You know, their loaded lineup and 54 runs allowed to date. 19 have been unearned variety, so Brian Bello could be outstanding out of the gate and continue that. I just don't buy it. They're my pretender.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to argue with you there. I was trying to be super positive about them coming into the season. I kind of picked them as a team that might surprise a little bit because everyone's just so down on them, like really just kicking them while they were down. And I kind of liked some of the sneaky pieces they had as the Tyler O'Neill bounce back, which has been real. I thought Trevor Story was going to bounce back. He looked like he was. And then the injury, I mean, that stinks. The pitching has been fantastic as far as the starters go. I think that's the one thing people are kind of keeping an eye on. Like, there's no way.
Cutter Crawford, we have to mention him by name too. I mean, he's been ridiculous, allowing only one earned run across, was it three starts? So he's been insane.
They all look improved. And Crawford's the kind of guy who, like, the stuff has always been there, but he's never been able to figure out how to be more than a five and fly guy. And it's starting to show that improvement, how to battle through. Like, it's about walks with him. If he can avoid that, then, I mean, he's got all the talent in the world. So, yeah, but with all that being said, it just seems like things are starting to go wrong, and I don't think they have any room for error, so I agree with you there.
As far as my contender here, of course, I love the Kansas City Royals, and I wanted to just be different here. I'm going with the Milwaukee Brewers and kind of took a hit here with some news that we're going to drop during our quick hitters after this. Christian Yelich hitting the IL, but he's playing like the MVP form we knew he could be a half decade ago at this point. And William Contreras, he's built upon what's like already a strong run from last year. I mean, I would say they're a pretty formidable 1-2 punch in the heart of the order. And they're getting surprising contributions from guys like Colin Rea, Joe Ross. So if we get some veterans contributing here, that division's wide open as well. NL Central could definitely be one. I think Milwaukee is for real here. They're going to be in it for the long haul. They sit right now atop the NL Central with Pittsburgh against really early. But either way, I think I'm buying the Milwaukee Brewers.
Yeah, especially in that division. I thought the Brewers were going to take a big, big step back. And I think I've been on here saying that. But again, another very, very winnable division. And you can't argue with performance, man. And I will say, William Contreras at catcher is better than I've realized. I think some people have been in on him for a couple of years now. And I don't know if I just wasn't paying attention, but he may be the best offensive catcher in the league. And I think a lot of stats are showing that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's a big piece to what, if Yelich can be who he is. And of course, he went down with the back strain, which seems tales all this time. And I'm sure Brewers fans are sick of hearing about it. But if you have that 1-2 punch in the middle of the lineup, that could definitely carry you across a lot of games. And like you said, if you get Colin Rea to do what he's been doing and you find some contributions from guys elsewhere, there is a good piece of this team that could be sustainable. And as you mentioned, playing in the NL Central, wide open. It's not like they're going to be facing an uphill climb, because I don't see anyone pulling away midsummer. This is going to be a dogfight all the way through the dog days of summer.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing who comes out of it, because I couldn't tell you right now.
So we're going to get some other quick notes here. We're going to hit our Oregon here to separate it, but we're going to have some quick notes and some unfortunate stuff that went on during this week. So we got some unfortunate news this morning that Hall of Fame manager Whitey Herzog has passed away at 92 years old. So the Cardinals announced this on Tuesday morning. Herzog's family provided a brief statement as relayed by USA Today's Bob Nightingale on Twitter. And I quote, "Whitey spent his last few days surrounded by his family. We have so appreciated all the prayers and support from friends who knew he was very ill. Although it was hard for us to say goodbye, his peaceful passing was a blessing for him." 92 years old, what a life lived. This guy has accomplished a lot, not only in baseball, but beyond. You know, one of the biggest names in baseball, and the Cardinals obviously paying tribute to him. MLB, Rob Manfred came out and said some nice things about him, but, you know, RIP to Whitey Herzog. But if we all could make it to 92 and live a life half as accomplished as his, I think we'd all be very happy with that.
Yeah, one of the best managers we've had in the game. As a Met fan, I listen to, you know, Gary Cohen, Keith Hernandez, and Ron Darling pretty much every night they're on. And Keith, as a former Cardinal, speaks about Whitey a lot. They had an interesting relationship. So a lot of what I know about Whitey Herzog is from little anecdotes from Keith Hernandez and a little bit about their relationship, but more so usually about just the amazing baseball man that Whitey was and the things that he was able to teach his players, and seemed like an unbelievable baseball man.
So I know we had some quotes here from Keith Hernandez, and I want you to feed to them and tell me what we're going to be listening to about what Keith was saying about Whitey Herzog when he played for him.
Yeah, so we have two clips here that we're going to look at. One of them is Keith's Cardinals kind of Hall of Fame speech when he's in front of all the ex-Cardinals, basically giving Whitey all the credit for bringing that team together, a very talented team that just needed some guidance. And then the other clip is interesting. It's more so about after Keith was traded. It kind of came out of nowhere, traded to the Mets. They didn't get a whole lot for him, and I think everyone was kind of flabbergasted. Keith was an MVP, still in the prime of his career. The Cardinals had won a World Series with him, and suddenly he was gone. And it was the clip you'll see about that one is Keith just kind of trying to, I don't know, come up with a reason for maybe why Whitey thought it was better to move on from Keith Hernandez.
So let's play the first one from the Hall of Fame speech when he talks about playing for Whitey Herzog and the difference he made for the 1982 Cardinals.
When the time came when the Cardinals hired Whitey Herzog to take over the ball club, we were a team that needed leadership and guidance. We had talent, a lot of young talent, but didn't know what to do with it. And we needed someone to lead us. And Whitey, from day one, the first meeting we had in spring training, set the tone and let it be known that he was in charge. And he really, I don't know if we would have turned it around and eventually win the 82 World Series, and I mean this, if it wasn't for Whitey. I learned a lot from Whitey. He made me a better player. That 82 group was the best group of players I'd ever played.
So obviously with Keith Hernandez, some great conversation about Whitey Herzog and his contributions to that team. Keith Hernandez knows better than anybody else how great of a manager he was. So your thoughts on that, Devin?
Well, I thought it was interesting because he specifically was saying like how they're kind of a young but unbelievably talented team, but they needed the right person to kind of bring all that together and just get it headed in the right direction. I think that's important because when you think about nowadays, so many people have kind of discredited what a manager does in today's game. Like, oh, basically all they do is manage a bullpen and they get their directions from the front office. And I think there's a little bit of truth to that, at least, especially for some managers. But what a manager, their most important thing they have to do, and maybe this is more important now than ever, is manage egos, keep a clubhouse together, and keep your guys ready to go and kind of worry about the little things. Buck Showalter amazed me with all the little pieces of the rule book he knew and knew how to expose that. I, even an avid baseball fan, there were some things I did not know about. And I feel like even guys in the booth, like Keith and Ron and Gary, were like, had never seen some of the things he'd done before. So the little things and keeping a clubhouse together, Whitey Herzog sounds like was one of the best at that. I'm just managing talent. Joe Torre is the other guy we think of as far as a guy like, oh, anybody could win with that team. No, not necessarily. Look at the Dodgers and how good they've been for, a million years now. And all they have is a 60-game World Series. Dave Roberts still has a job, but I'm surprised there's not more conjecture about, like, how has he not gotten them to win more?
Yeah, I mean, it's about pushing the right buttons. And why do you seem to push the right buttons when he's in there? And you referenced Joe Torre, but, all the guys there are kind of the old school mentality and they all stepped in the footsteps of Whitey Herzog. So, but the other thing you talk about keeping the locker room together. And of course, Keith Hernandez notoriously a part of that 1986 Mets team. All the stories there are now living in lore with the party nature of the clubhouse. But we have a clip here about Keith Hernandez talking about Whitey and his first impression of what he thought of Keith Hernandez.
This is the kind of guy they need right now.
Whitey didn't like me for some reason. Didn't like the way I played. I know some of my teammates told me that Whitey would ask questions. He didn't like me. I was a chatterbox. He didn't like that I talked all the time. I just never felt that I lived up to his expectation.
So we always wondered why Keith Hernandez was sent off the pasture and went over. I mean, obviously the Mets fans are happy he did. But they really didn't get a lot for him. And I think it might have been a character issue more so than he was a chatterbox.
Yeah, earlier in that clip, we didn't play it, but one of his old teammates had kind of said that they weren't sure why the deal was made, but they had heard that, you know, Herzog had maybe gotten wind of Keith being, you know, someone who was dealing with drugs at that time, not dealing drugs, but having an issue with drugs. and it's interesting because some of those managers, such as a Joe Torre, or go to a different sport, a Bill Belichick, some of them that are so good like to take on guys that have maybe character issues and people fall in line for them because of their success. Whereas Herzog, it sounded like he didn't want any outside issues. He wanted guys that were, you know, going to be straight laced and good St. Louis Cardinals. And it makes sense for the team that that's kind of always seems to be the way of the St. Louis Cardinals. So I guess we'll never truly know how 100% how that came together, but a little bit of history. Thank goodness for the Mets, because the Mets were terrible at the time. And that was one of the first big pieces to turn things around for us.
So some big news in New York here was the news about John Sterling retiring, and the voice synonymous with the New York Yankees is just calling it quits. And it's a weird time to do it because the season's already kicking off, and John Sterling, came out and it was effective immediately. And he posted, the Yankees posted a statement just saying that, they're going to hold a ceremony for him pretty quickly before Saturday's game against the Rays. And Andrew Martian was reporting for The Athletic and said that he's stepping down due to, quote, health concerns. Michael Kay on the YES Network during the Yankee play-by-play rebutted that, saying he just didn't want to do it anymore. But Sterling does plan to speak with the media during his ceremony on Saturday. Listen, dude, 85 years old. He's called the Yankees since 1989, 5,420 regular season games, 211 playoff games. The dude just doesn't want to do the travel anymore. And I think that's truly what it was. I think he probably did that first road trip and was like, not for me. And at 85 years old, you only have so much time left. Hopefully we get another 15 years of John Sterling where he can be alive and spend time with his family. But at 85 years old, sometimes that just clicks in your brain. Like, what am I doing? I can't really withstand the travel.
Yeah, man. Like, I don't know if he has grandkids, but if he does, go make up some clever calls for your grandkids' Little League games or something. Or if they're older, middle school or high school games, like, enjoy your life a little bit. I get it. There are people that when they find something they're so passionate about and they get to do something they enjoy every day, they don't want to give it up. And you even look at like Vin Scully, who obviously did it for so long, but it seemed like Vin Scully retired and then suddenly he was gone. Like, we didn't have Vin Scully anymore around. So hopefully Sterling's health is okay, or will be okay, or will be better for this. We don't know if it's necessarily that. My guess is it's a mix of both. He didn't want to do it anymore, and health issues are making it more difficult. So, he's been the Yankee radio guy since we can remember.
I mean, the quick turnaround for the ceremony on Saturday has me concerned. The first thing I thought about was like, why are they rushing to do this? And I understand 85 years old, nothing's guaranteed. Tomorrow is not guaranteed to be here, but the rush had me concerned, especially paired with the health concerns. Like, how serious are we looking at this that we want to honor him on the field? But, everyone, it's interesting. You and I were talking off air about this with just longevity. And we see this across different platforms, and you and I are wrestling fans. And for the longest time, everyone's been so critical of the announcers in WWE, and Michael Cole being the ire of most people's anger at the production because it's polished. And you can make the argument he was always just had Vince McMahon in his ear, blah blah blah. But it's weird how time just like buffs out the edges for some of these guys. And John Sterling, for the longest time, if you don't live in New York, you probably don't understand what I'm saying here about this. Everyone knew 10 years ago this probably should have happened, that he should have moved on, the Yankees being the utmost professional franchise in the world. Their play-by-play team was Susan Wallman and John Sterling. And yes, they're like a warm, comfy blanket. But if you're looking, if you're in the car, I can't tell you how many times I'm in the car driving, trying to catch the score. You'd be listening to the game and not really sure what's actually going on. That's not to say his contributions aren't amazing. He used to do the TV announcing as well. So he has a long list of accomplishments, and the end of the day, appreciate the good times, but at this point it's good for a younger voice to step in and be there for him. It's the same thing across all different platforms and employments. Sometimes a new person, this makes room for somebody else to step in and live their dream. And let's be honest, like, they're ready for it. So, I understand John Stern's contributions and I appreciate everything he's done, but it's going to be a breath of fresh air to have someone else on the WFAN airwaves for the Yankee games.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how whoever the new person is, how they mix with Susan, though, because Susan and John, I mean, it's one of the most, unique, I would say, radio broadcasts that you'll listen to. And if you haven't listened to it before, you might be a little bit confused as to what's actually going on. But with all that being said, do you have a favorite call of his as far as a player over the years, or a least favorite, or both?
I would say, I mean, his unique calls definitely were exciting. The A-bomb from A-Rod, I remember, I mean, especially the 09 season, that was, I liked when they would put the packages together of all the announcers. Like, obviously, you'd have Michael Kay, and then you'd have John Sterling, and MLB Network does such a good job of every team. They put the radio announcing over the highlight clip. But just, you know, I think back to the playoff games and being in the car, being a young kid listening, and John Sterling's on the radio, or even in the summer, he is the soundtrack to your summer. And I know, you know, at the end of the day, I think baseball's moved in a different direction, analytic, and they were not those presentations. John Sterling and Susan Waldman, they were going to paint a picture very different than, you know, you're going to get some of the broadcasts with maybe the mid-30s, early-40s baseball lifers that are into analytics and telling you the story with those numbers. They're more of the illustration of just what's going on in the background, or having side conversation about what's going on in their day, talking about everything else, but sometimes what's on the game in front of them. So, you know, my memories there are just like, you know, sometimes, you know, obviously doing the, or being interested, like we got the Soto call when he first came here. So that is kind of apropos that we did get to see that with Soto's home run, but you know, he has a lot of memorable calls here. The A-bomb from A-Rod definitely sticks most in my head.
Yeah. Even as a Met fan, someone who, you know, doesn't listen to a ton of Yankee radio, that's the one, the first one that comes to mind, my mind is that one as well.
But think about 1989, that's the year I was born. So my whole life, he literally was calling Yankee games. And Bezzotto was texting me earlier today about just John Sterling. We were talking about, it's kind of the same conversation, how like, isn't it weird how everyone just almost forgets that they were looking for a breath of fresh air for this? Because there's a frustration from a Yankee fan when you're in the car and you can't listen to the game. You want to know what's going on, and sometimes it would go 5-10 minutes without even understanding what the score is. But you know, the number that's in your head, he's called 30% of Yankee games in the entire history, which is crazy to even think about. Like, if you look at that number as far as across that's an insane number for how long the Yankees have been around. That one voice has been elaborately across the track here. Good, bad, or indifferent, John Sterling was there for all these moments.
Yeah, that is a crazy percentage to think about the Yankees history. You kind of make a point, like, especially radio, you're supposed to paint the picture for the listener, right? And they need to be able to picture everything in their head. My guy Howie Rose, I feel like, still does a great job of that, where like every little detail, like you can actually picture in between pitches what's going on at the ballpark, because he'll paint that picture for you. So I mean, you know, all props to John Sterling. The longevity is unbelievable, and I'm glad he listened to, you know, I don't know whether it was his body or just his conscience, that it was time for him to go, and he didn't wait till the end of the season. So I give someone credit for doing that just right away.
So we also have some interesting stuff, and I always pop for this when things happen here. So Luis Gil, we had something called Scoregami. So if you didn't know this was a thing, and some stats keep track of it, that there's unique lines in each game, of course. So Luis Gil threw a game that's never happened in the history of baseball. So he allowed 10 base runners in just 5 innings of work with 6 strikeouts to help limit the damage to just 3 runs. And you say, like, why is that even an interesting stat line? Well, it's the first time ever over the course of 1.1 million performances that this line has happened. 5 innings pitched, 3 hits, 3 runs, 3 earned runs, 7 walks, and 6 Ks. So it was the first among more than, as I mentioned before, 1.1 million MLB pitching lines in the regular season or postseason since 1901. So it's thanks to Baseball Reference and Stathead that Luis Gil is the proud owner of that very mediocre stat line that's never been had before.
When you showed this to me, or when I read this, I know what Scoregami is because of football, with the, you know, unique football final scores, but I couldn't believe that there is a pitching line like this, as weird as it is, that's never happened in the history of baseball. Like, that's it like blew my mind, and it took me a while to actually,
like, even weirder, I guess, is someone found that out and sat there and be like, wait a minute. This is the first time we've ever had 3 earned runs and 7 walks and 6 Ks at the same time.
You're right. That is stranger.
I always think the same. I mean, the same thing with they have the stats so readily on hand, and sometimes it's Elias and sometimes it's just the guy working behind the scenes. So they're feeding to the play-by-play guys in baseball, but also like hockey and football, where they said this is the first time that this has happened on this day. And a certain, it just, it's crazy that they can feed it so fast. And the age of technology, this is technology being used in a great way. I like that they have this database that you have someone tapping into, whether it's AI sifting through it or not. I just think it's awesome to have that information at the tip of our fingers.
It's unbelievable. I mean, we have everything we want, like you said, at a moment's notice. So the fact that someone found that out, and I guess I wouldn't be surprised if we hear another one of these before the season's over.
So we also have Justin Verlander being back this weekend, and the conversation veers towards how big is that for the Astros, who have been less than inspiring. So the three-time Cy Young Award winner is looking to be sort of a savior. And he opened the season on the IL with inflammation in his right shoulder. He's made two rehab starts, first with AAA Sugarland on April 7th, and then AA Corpus Christi on Saturday. He's excited to be back. He definitely wasn't thrilled with the results of his rehab starts. Pretty angry there, if you listen to him talk about it. But he said those games were valuable in getting prepared. He allowed 7 hits and 6 runs, 5 earned in 4 innings against Frisco on Saturday. He struck out 3, walked 1, and threw 51 of 77 pitches for strikes. And then Verlander allowed 6 runs and struck out 6 while pitching in the 4th inning for Sugarland. So not great. The results weren't there, but the fact that he didn't get hurt again, the fact that his elbow or shoulder wasn't barking, has to be great news. Because, you know, once he gets back on the mound in Houston, Minute Maid Park's going to jar some things loose here, and I feel like he's going to have muscle memory, and all of a sudden we're going to have the Cy Young caliber Justin Verlander again in those tight pants on the mound in Houston. Like, right? Aren't we expecting to see that?
He's got to be careful with the tight pants with these uniforms, man. Like, I don't – just saying. I don't know, man. I'm not super optimistic here for the Astros. I can say from experience, you do not want over 40-year-old pitchers having to be your saviors. So if Verlander was walking back through the door when the Astros were cruising, like he's kind of done in the past, I'd say, oh, great, this is a great addition. But you've said this many times before, so I'm going to use one of your sayings, and that's time is undefeated, right? Eventually, time catches up with everybody. And Verlander now, over the years, especially the last couple, has had a couple injuries kind of pile up. And lucky for him, a few of them haven't been these huge things, right? But little by little, it happens. So I don't know. I hope he comes back and he's fine and he's good. I don't think he's going to be prime Justin Verlander, but he could be a very, very solid pitcher still. The guy knows how to pitch. But I'm not sitting here saying that it's a huge deal and it's going to get the Astros going and they're going to be over 500 in the blink of an eye. I think the team's got some issues. I think Josh Hader at the back of the bullpen, so far being a huge bust, is a problem. I think that's a big, big problem because you unseated your other closer, Ryan Pressly, who is still on the roster, and put Hader there. Things like that can get messy real quick.
And they're in the midst of a tough series right now against the Braves, and the Braves are up 1-0 as we speak in top of the 7th. They're at the risk of falling to 6-13, which is not the start that the Astros were looking at. As I mentioned before, tongue-in-cheek, Justin Verlander coming back was not supposed to be looked at as a savior. He was supposed to be looked at as, let's let him get comfortable, we'll ease him into the season. This is not the scenario he probably was expecting to join Houston. This is uncharted territory for this team, and I'm not sure if anyone's panicking, and I don't know many Astro fans, but I'm curious if you guys are out there listening to our show, are you guys panicking about this start? 6-13, 6-12, or even if it's going to fall, if they pull out this one against Atlanta, 7-12 is still a start you are not used to in Houston. We're used to them getting off to a hot start and kind of carrying their way and just fighting people off. This is not the team I think Verlander was expecting to come back to. And like you said before, being that he has overcome the injuries, he has a lot of innings on that shoulder. He's definitely been out there doing his thing for a while. And he, of course, is accomplished. And there will be games he shines. You know, there's going to be games where he just goes out there and he absolutely looks like the part, like turning back the clock. But for the most part, 41 years old, I think the better half of his career is behind him. We saw that in New York. And of course, that was a mess with what was going on with him and Scherzer over here. But I mean, they can sprinkle some magic dust on it, but I think some of that magic dust was spider tack. So I'm not quite sure if they can fix it as much as they probably want to, but who knows, man. I mean, sometimes a change of scenery is all you need.
A lot of 5 inning outings for him last year. And I watched a good amount of those with the Mets, but a lot of 5 inning outings, which was just un-Verlander like. There are a lot of games I watched where he just seemed to get to 2 strikes and then have trouble putting guys away and just looked frustrated because that never was much of a problem for him. So, and he's got to know That's not his team anymore. That is Ronel Blanco's team. Ronel Blanco took his locker. He kicked him off. Verlander's got to get changed in the bathroom now. So, no, I mean.
You want this team throw no hitter, Verlander. You want it back. But those pants can't be too tight with those Fanatics uniforms. It's a dangerous, dangerous game.
Very dangerous.
So speaking of the Mets, they jump back to 500 quicker than anyone could have expected here. And I'll let you take the lead on here because really for Mets fans, nothing has come easy for you guys and for the team. But with some calm and serenity and feels like they've eased their way back in, they're back to 500. Starting the season 0-5, this could have got out of control very quickly. But to sit here that they're at 500 on April 16th, I mean, come on. No one expected this.
This is the Mets roller coaster, man. Buckle in, buckle up, and just get ready because they're actually now one game over 500. They took care of the Pirates again tonight in another comeback effort. I think thankfully for them, Jared Jones was on a five-inning limit. I think he threw like 60-something pitches. If he was not a rookie, he may have thrown a complete game shutout against them tonight. He looked that good. But listen. Mets took care of business, got to the Pittsburgh bullpen, shook things up, and all of a sudden they look like this clutch team with timely hitting, where in that 0-5 stretch, they could not get a timely hit for the life of them. Some of their most important hitters were all struggling mightily at the same time. And you know what? Steve Cohen had a quote after the 0-5 start where he said something along the lines of, listen, all teams go through losing streaks. We just so happen to be going through one right away. And I'll be honest, I was so frustrated in the beginning of the season that we got off to that start that I saw that quote and it pissed me off. I was like, you got to be kidding me. Like, this is a stupid thing to say. And now I look at it and I'm like, well, I guess he has a point because it was just a losing streak and it's not going to be the last one we have. And we got one out of the way. There's a lot of things to like. Their team ERA is one of the best in the league. Their bullpen has looked very, very good. Reed Garrett looks like quite a find. This guy is one of the best bullpen arms as of now. That can change quick, but in the league right now, Edwin Diaz looks healthy. He's not throwing his fastball as hard, but maybe he's just kind of, you know, getting back up to speed little by little, not trying to push it. Still successful. Timely hitting. Harrison Bader, another guy I owe an apology. In our fantasy chat, I think I was cursing him out multiple times the first week because the guy was swinging at anything and everything. And all of a sudden, there's great defense in center. We saw him making a great play today, sliding towards the wall. He's had some big hits late innings the last week or two. It's kind of exciting. Everything's put together all of a sudden. And JD Martinez isn't here yet because of his back. And he'll be here eventually. A lot of things to like. And we have some, and we'll talk about this probably more as the season goes on. There's some stud pitchers down in AAA, AA that I think we're going to see at some point help this team out. But a shout out to Jose Budo too, because this guy I think was kind of laughed at as an option for the Mets, but I think he's found something. I think he might be legit.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned before, and we were discussing this on the show, and I know it's frustrating to watch a team start 0-5, and you have a five-game losing streak. Pretty much every team goes through that. To have it happen at the beginning of the season, the word is demoralizing, to start the season and just feel that way. And all you're asking for, and I think most baseball fans are level-headed, unless you are one of those exaggerated Yankee fans or a Dodger fan that just says it's World Series or bust. All we're asking for is an entertaining season to be the soundtrack of our summers, to have something to root for, to go to the ballpark and have hope. And it seemed quickly that in Queens, the hope was disappearing. It's like, can we at least get to June, July and have some level of prospect of this team being competitive? And they quickly snatched some success out of the jaws of agony at this point, where the Mets were teetering with disaster, because we can see how quickly it can turn in the other direction. We lost the Marlins, who started the season much worse than them, and they haven't really climbed out of it quite yet, and it can just compound on itself. And the Mets didn't let them do that. And that this might be a character-building moment for a team that sees, wow, we overcame that. What else can we do? So, you know, paired with the timely hitting, some of the good pitching in the bullpen, I have a lot to be excited about as a Met fan.
Yeah, you got to look at who they beat, too. Two out of three from the Braves. In Atlanta, two out of three against the Royals when they choked the second game away. I think it was the second game, first or second game of that series. And again, we've talked about how good the Royals have been this year. And now the first two from the Pirates, who have also been very, very good this year, another young upstart team. Like, these have been solid, solid wins, like character building wins. And they're going to see the Dodgers soon. that's a big series. But if they can go in there with the confidence that they probably have right now, that's big time, man. That's big time. So it's exciting. I'm sure there's more ups and downs to come on the New York Mets roller coaster.
So as the weather gets warmer, Mets fans show up to the ballpark, support this team. There was 18,266 fans at Monday night Citi Field witnessing the win. We need more than that there in the building. So I know it's cold. I know it's cold. But I get that. So
I will say, I'll just add one more thing to that. Hopefully the warm weather helps, and now the winning ways help as well, because the Mets fans gave Francisco Lindor the Trey Turner treatment the other night or day, with the standing ovation in his first bat at bat back from the road trip, which was a nice gesture. You know, someone had tweeted it and Steve Cohen had kind of backed it and they did it. But at the same time, I was slightly embarrassed because when Trey got that treatment, it was like a packed house in Philly. And Citi Field was like not even half full. And like, so they're showing the standing ovation and it's like, it's cool, but like it would have looked cooler with a packed house.
Well, sticking with the NL East here, of course, we talked about Spencer Strider as one of our big stories last week. He officially went under the knife for that internal brace procedure. So to give you guys a timeline, 2 weeks ago, Spencer Strider looked healthy. He was good. Everything was copacetic. He was the ace of the staff. 1 week ago, as we discussed, he was placed on the IL, and everyone had hope that the elbow MRI would come back positive, but it revealed a damaged ulnar collateral ligament, which meant he needs that internal brace surgery, which he had this past Friday to support the UCL, and now he's going to miss the remainder of the season and perhaps some of next year. So absolutely awful news for baseball, absolutely awful news for the Braves, bad news for everybody. But, you know, at this point, we're looking at Strider as far as the rest of his recovery here, you start to have to look at his trajectory for what's going to be happening from here. Because right now, you know, he ascended from being a draft pick to prospect to reliever to ace. And it all happened so goddamn quickly that, you know, he all of a sudden was throwing everything that was unhittable. And the sliders, I think, were the biggest difference, that pairing at that, he learned a new pitch. And I mean, he became one of the best five or six starters in all baseball. It might be the best pitcher in all baseball when healthy. NL Cy Young favorite, exciting arm in the game. But his future right now, like, I don't want to be all doom and gloom, but recovering from this after a second Tommy John surgery. Well, let me correct myself. He had one Tommy John surgery and then he opted to go for this internal brace. I just don't know what to expect from him. Is this going to be something he comes back better from? Or is this going to be like a case of what could have been if he didn't get hurt? This is terrible, terrible news here. And I think with the recovery rates for the internal brace in the immediate, we know what the Tommy John does. It does, it repairs it. And sometimes you're throwing 3 or 4 miles per hour faster than you last threw the ball. I don't think there's enough data right now with the internal brace procedure outside of you get a faster recovery time. So I don't know how he's going to bounce back. Is he going to lose some miles per hour off this fastball? Is this all going to be something that we're going to be looking at as, like, I don't know, is the Spencer Strider going to be the same pitcher? And that sucks, man. I'm not even a Braves fan, and it breaks my heart because he was so exciting to watch.
Yeah, I mean, he's electric. I think you're onto something when you say we're going into the unknown here because, yes, there's been guys, plenty of guys now, unfortunately, that have had two Tommy Johns. Think about Jacob deGrom, who still isn't back from his second. I think Walker Buehler will be back from his second soon. There's a bunch more as well, but I don't know how many, if any, have had the regular Tommy John procedure and then the internal brace. I don't know. And even if there are people who have done that, it's got to be a pretty small sample size of, you know, major league level guys, as far as, you know, having data with how they come back. Another piece of this is it's just interesting to see what has happened to the Braves rotation of the future. Like as of like 2-3 years ago, what we kind of labeled as that. We now look at the Braves as this team who has done an amazing job putting together a core of offensive players that they have locked up. And it's funny because the Mets have always gotten so much crap over the years, multiple times, multiple different rotations where they just couldn't keep a rotation together that was great, or no one was ever healthy at the same time. We talk about Wheeler, Harvey, DeGrom, even Steven Matz back then. But even go back in the Bill Pulsifer days, and it just has happened a lot. This has kind of happened to the Braves. You just don't hear much negativity about them because they're such a good team still. They seem to be able to overcome it. But you think about, at one point, it looked like it was going to be Mike Soroka, Kyle Wright, Spencer Strider, Max Fried, who's obviously still there, but will be a free agent at the end of the year. He's one guy that they have not locked up, which seems a little suspicious with how the Braves operate. That kind of tells me he might have one foot out the door. So, yeah, I mean, Kyle Wright's in Kansas City, probably won't pitch this year. Mike Soroka had all the injury issues. And he, if you don't remember before the Achilles stuff, that dude looked like a Cy Young, a multiple time Cy Young winner in the future. He really did. He was dominant, unhittable at times. So you think of those two guys that moved on to different teams, and now Spencer Strider, who knows? So it's interesting. I mean, it's the Braves again. They're going through some things right now, and you hear very little negativity about, oh, you know, they're going to go downhill. People just think they'll be fine.
I think the Braves will be fine, but I'm looking at Strider, the pitcher. You mentioned Soroka, and I know Soroka had the Achilles situation. It wasn't the same as needing a whole reconstruction of your arm, but you could see it turn so quickly where you don't, as much as they could be Justin Verlander with longevity, they very easily could be Kerry Wood. Like there's no fine line between that you can wake up tomorrow and Spencer Strider comes back next year and he just looks lost. I mean, not that Alek Manoah overcame injury, but look at Alek Manoah. I mean, Alek Manoah was a top pitcher in baseball, a finalist for the AL Cy Young, and now he can't get guys out in Double A. So it's just like it disappears very quickly. And I'm not doom and gloom. I'm hoping Strider's going to be okay. And then by the time he comes back next year, this internal brace procedure will be there. They have proven it's better recovery rates, but this is a new path. Let's not mistake anything about it. This is not something a lot of people have done outside of just amateur pitchers. So it's so new that there's really no long-term data of how they're going to perform after. And it could be better. We do know with the Tommy John, because it's been done so often for almost every pitcher, it's about 60 to 70% that it's going to be successful and they're going to return to form, if not a little bit better. So I think he opted for this new procedure. It's less invasive. I don't know, dude. It's at the very least, we talked about it last week. So go back and listen to our episode talking about the injury to all the pitchers here, talking about everything with Framber Valdez and, you know, go down the list, Jacob DeGrom, everyone that's been out here for a while. This is the latest example of it. This is an issue that's not going away, and the Players Association is not going to rest until things like this get solved, because at the end of the day, baseball is only successful for the players on the field. And if a guy like Spencer Strider can't be on the field, baseball is worse for it.
No doubt about it. You want all your stars there. You want all of them there, offensively, defensively, pitching. It's a shame what's happened so far in the beginning of the season. Hopefully the injury rate slows way down.
So we do have a couple of rookie pitchers looking good in their debuts. I'll let you lead us through this. There are two guys that you mentioned before in passing throughout our preview of the AL Central and also the NL East, but give a little love to these guys.
All right. So yeah, the first one, Nick Nastrini, Chicago White Sox pitcher. I'll be honest, it caught me by surprise that he was called up so early in the season. He was a guy I expected to see at some point this year, but White Sox aren't, you know, playing for much this year. So I kind of expected them to be careful and let him get comfortable, get some reps in AAA and call him up maybe later towards September. But he came up and held his own against a very hot Royals team. Five innings pitched, two runs on three hits, two walks, five strikeouts. White Sox ended up losing 2-0 because they're the White Sox. But, you know, a nice thing to hang your hat on if you're a White Sox fan, obviously looking towards the future. We know how quick the turnaround can be sometimes for some of these teams. If you look back 2-3 years ago and look at the teams that were losing 100 games, which we're actually going to talk about a little bit, some of those teams are doing very, very well now. So I think the White Sox are doing it right. They're basically doing a complete teardown for the most part here. And sometimes that's the way to go rather than to go kind of half-ass, just break it down and let's get started building the future. So they have some young pieces. Now they have to prove that the organization can actually develop these guys that are super talented because the White Sox have had trouble doing that as well. And then the other one was Mitchell Parker, who, I'll be honest, Mitchell Parker is not a name I'd heard. I've heard a lot of the Nationals prospects. They're loaded in some ways, but this one caught me by surprise. And when I saw he was going against the Dodgers, as a guy who's playing fantasy and sometimes streaming, I wanted no part of it, but I was wrong. Five innings pitched, two earned runs, four hits, zero walks, four strikeouts. And the Nationals pulled out a win here against the mighty Dodgers 6-4. So good for Mitchell Parker.
Yeah. 21. He's listed number 21 on their prospect list. So he's not even top 15 to be greeted by three MVPs, starting with Mookie and then going down the list here. I mean, how could you have a better first start as far as a guy who's, largely unheralded. I'm sure people that are familiar with Washington and their system, this dude went in there with a task that they probably expected, like, let's just have this kid eat some innings here and get through the day. But I mean, they saw something here, and we'll see what Mitchell Parker brings to the table. Cause as we know, similar to the White Sox, the Nats really have nothing really to lose by just letting these guys go out and play. And you might find some gems here, as we know. And Mitchell Parker seems like, again, one start against a really good lineup. We'll see if he can continue it, but the Nats beating the Dodgers 6-4. I mean, it's the first win by a Nationals rookie starting pitcher in his debut since, I mean, we all know the name, Steven Strasburg, June 8th, 2010. So some impressive stuff. I mean, he got Mookie swinging on a fastball up in the zone for his first career strikeout, and that was off to the races from there. So I was impressed as well watching the highlights.
And yeah, maybe he'll be a part of the future here, because the Nationals are going to be one of those teams that pretty soon are going to be very fun, a la the Orioles and the Pirates. You know, who knows if they'll put wins together right away, but they have some – they have some really, really high-level prospects that will be here, some this year and some next year, some the year after that. So they're going to get fun pretty quick.
So we have some quick quickies here talking about some news that hit here. So Seiya Suzuki hit the IL with a right oblique strain. Doesn't think it's as bad as the left oblique strain that sidelined him for 6 weeks last season. So we shall see, Devin. I think anytime you hear an oblique, it seems like it's going to be a long haul and be fighting it all season.
Yeah, I don't buy him saying it's not as bad. Oblique is a pain in the ass when you're swinging a baseball bat for a living.
So Tommy Pham finally signed a free agent deal with the White Sox. It's a minor league deal. We'll see what Tommy Pham does. We know what Tommy Pham, he's waiting for a deal. The White Sox are going to need help at the major league level. So it's only a matter of time before Tommy Pham is in that lineup, right? Like next week, we're going to be seeing him, hopefully.
There have been some puzzling transactions this year. Put this one right up there. Max Meyer was optioned to AAA the other day with Marlins. He was like been their best starter. That was pretty puzzling. Go back to Esturi Ruiz, which we talked about being sent down to AAA by the A's. And now this one, how did Tommy Pham only get a minor league deal? Like, this tells me no one else was offering him anything, because why would he accept a minor league deal from a crappy White Sox team? Like, it makes sense for the White Sox, because if he does well, they'll, you know, ship him off for a piece or two, like the Mets did last year to the Diamondbacks. But Tommy Pham performed last year. Like, he's on the World Series, Diamondbacks team that went to the World Series, played really well for the Mets. I was flabbergasted that this is where he lands on a minor league deal, much less. I couldn't believe it.
So we also had some follow through of this Tyler O'Neill and Rafael Devers colliding with each other on a pop-up. O'Neill wound up getting 8 stitches, and both players are being tested for concussion. So if you didn't see the highlights, a pretty nasty collision. Seemed like both are okay. Of course, 8 stitches is, you know, one thing, but concussions are another. We watched Anthony Rizzo lose pretty much the whole season to a concussion. So hopefully both these guys are fine. But the collision was pretty nasty. Never want to see that.
Yeah, it looked like O'Neill took the brunt of it, got the back of Devers' head to the front of O'Neill's head. O'Neill has cleared concussion protocol, which is good news. Cora said they kept him out tonight, and they expect to keep him out tomorrow. He has a chance to play Thursday. I wouldn't be surprised to see him miss a couple more days just to be careful. It does sound like he'll avoid the IL. I hope he comes right back in and everything's really fine, because I mean, he was bouncing back, a guy that the Cardinals kind of forgot about. There was also some injuries that messed with him. But if you look back a couple years ago, he looked like a budding superstar, a guy that can do a little bit of everything, obviously has muscles on muscles on muscles, was leading the league in home runs here early on in the season. So he's a guy we want to see out there, like a fun guy to watch, all the power in the world. So hopefully this does not, mess him up very much.
So speaking of being out there, Walker Buehler is set for his second rehab start. He could return to the Dodgers rotation next week, which the risks get richer. We'll see if Walker Buehler, bringing you back to fantasy baseball, almost forgot about him because of how loaded the Dodgers are. Walker Buehler is going to be joining a team that really doesn't need another superstar. But if Walker Buehler is half the pitcher we know he can be, the dangerous get a little bit more dangerous.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's a free agent at the end of the year too. That's interesting. From what I see, like even social media interactions and things like that, he sounds like a guy who wants to be a part of the Dodgers for life. You know, he's not locked up. I'm sure the Dodgers, smart business decision, see how he looks after, you know, a big, big injury. That's my interest is to see, all right, how does he look and does he end up with the Dodgers after this year?
So we also have, speaking of a former Dodger, Max Scherzer has moved up his timeline to come back from June to May. So a month in advance here. And again, similar to the Verlander stuff, the question remains, can he stay healthy, and has father time evaporated all of the skill set that we've been so familiar with? Because we've been waiting for, I don't know, the bottom to fall out, and we'll see if Scherzer can come back to form. I'm a little bit hesitant to back that horse, but we shall see. At least the timeline's moved up, so things are going in the right direction.
Yeah, I think at this point in his career, he's the kind of guy who he's going to still have his strikeouts, but I would be surprised to see him go out there and give up less than 3 or 4 runs each outing. I'm not saying there's not going to be a dominant start mixed in there. I think there will be, but my expectation is 5-6 innings most of the times out, 3-4 runs, and a high strikeout number. That's what I expect from Max Scherzer.
So speaking of rehab starts, John Means will make a third rehab start as he's trying to make his way back to the Orioles. And again, you know, John Means is one of those guys who was a bright spot in a season that the Orioles weren't so good. Now the Orioles are pretty damn good, and John Means coming back, if he can be, again, similar we said with Walker and same thing with Scherzer, he could be a big piece for the Orioles that they weren't even counting on. So this could be interesting for them.
Yeah, John Means, again, yeah, kind of forgotten. He came back last year, and I think maybe a little bit too much too fast, where then he ended up, I want to say he might have missed the postseason or maybe the end of the regular season, something, or maybe he just wasn't pitching well. But they opted to be very careful with him coming into the season here, kind of delay him. His first couple starts back last year when he did come back were very, very good. I think he even flirted with a no-hitter once, came very, very close, maybe even 8 2/3, if I'm remembering correctly, and gave up a hit at the end, something along those lines. It was very close. But when John Means is right, he can be a frustrating pitcher to face. He's not a guy who's going to light up the radar gun, but he can pitch. He pitches. So I'm looking forward to seeing what he does. That's a fun team, so I'm rooting for his success.
So the Astros are recalling former top prospect Forrest Whitley for his first Major League Baseball promotion. This is according to Michael Schwab of the Juice Box Journal. I want to give some love to that source for the Astros. I like that name. He's already on the 40-man roster, so they only need to make a corresponding active roster transaction. Forrest Whitley has been wildly disappointing ever since he was heralded as like the savior of that organization at one point. We'll see what he can do. I had stashed him in the Fantasy Baseball League at one point. The Astros are looking for some reinforcements, and here comes Forrest Whitley. Not what you're relying on.
I mean, we talk about Jack Leiter being kind of a post-hype guy. If he's post-hype, Forrest Whitley is there's got to be a different word. We're way, way, way past the hype, so who knows?
So we also talked about some injuries here. Ozzie Albies is hitting the IL with a broken toe. News has said he does not need surgery. David Fletcher is called up as well, and also signed Yuli Gurriel. So sucks for Ozzie Albies. It seems like these appendages seem to get hurt. I know he had a wrist injury a few years ago. I know he had slid into second base and hurt his finger, and now a broken toe. It seems like these things are unavoidable and they're freak accidents. It's not preparation. You can't get around this stuff, but the fact he doesn't need surgery means that he probably will be back sometime this season. It just sucks because he's a big piece of that lineup.
Yeah, man. Drink some milk, Ozzy. You need some calcium breaking these random bones. I mean, listen, you're not going to replace Ozzy Albies with David Fletcher or Gurriel. It's a downgrade. But I think the Braves are hoping that it's not a big thing. It's just got to heal right. He played the entire game after he did this yesterday. I don't think he realized what it was. He said he didn't realize until he took his cleat off and his socks off in the post game, and obviously could tell something was wrong. It just doesn't feel right. I guess when the adrenaline wears off, that's when you start to feel it. So we'll see. But the Braves here are getting a little banged up. So we'll see how good they are, just how good they are.
So finishing up our quick quickies over here, the Brewers announced that Christian Yelich is placed on the 10-day injury list, which is retroactive to April 13th. Due to, you guessed it, if you've been following Yelich's career, lower back strain. So Owen Miller was recalled as a corresponding move, but this is a bad move. As I was talking about during our pretenders and contenders, Yelich has returned to MVP form. He's been absolutely torrid, hitting the ball 333, 422, 744 slash line in his first 11 games. And most importantly, the power seems to be back, 5 home runs. So that pace wasn't going to be around forever, but the fact that we're now so early in the season and the back injuries looming again has to be worrisome, because this is what's been bogging him down since really his stint starting with the Brewers, ever since he came over from Miami.
Yeah, man, it doesn't seem like we're that far removed from the Christian Yelich, Cody Bellinger, like MVP fight season. Remember that? Like they were just both of them going nuts. And, you know, Bellinger refound his form last year a bit. And Yelich, we see flashes, and we've kind of seen the flashes this year. And then the back is just a nagging thing, man. So hopefully not a long-term injury, and hopefully he can get past it.
The fact that it's 10-day and it's retroactive has me believing that it's just they need to do something as far as the next few games, and he'll be back as soon as he's able. So we shall see. That would mean he would be returning next week, which hopefully, fingers crossed, he can continue, because right in the middle of a heater like he's on right now, that's the last time you want to go on the IL. But let's get into Take a Pitch, Swing Away, our buy or sell segment here. Three topics here that we're going to be interestingly debating. All right, Take a Pitch or Swing Away here, and I'll pass it to you first. We have four teams here potentially to lose 100-plus games, on the pace to lose well more than that. The Nationals, the Athletics, the Rockies, and the Marlins. So I asked you, Devin, three of the four, will they lose 100-plus games? Because for context right now, in the 2019 season, we had 400-loss teams. We had the Orioles, the Marlins, the Royals, and the Tigers. And then we had the 2021 season, of course, skipping over 2020, which is not – you can't compare it because of the shortened season. The Orioles, Rangers, Pirates, and Diamondbacks. 2022 had the A's, Nationals, Reds, and Pirates. 2023, last year, the White Sox, A's, and Royals, and also the Rockies. So that's – let's just say, I mean, we're on a trend. We're having four of these teams finishing with 100 loss, and that's a different conversation. Like, why the hell is that happening? Because it used to be rare for that to happen. But do you believe buy or sell three or four of these teams will lose 100-plus games?
So my initial gut reaction when I read it was, oh, I'm definitely taking the pitch there. Like, there's no way four, like, you know, three or four teams, come on. And then I read all the history there, recent history, and it's like, oh, well. And I'll tell you why. It's because the teams, more and more organizations, I feel like the Astros kind of made it cooler, like punting and tearing down to then try to build back up. And because it's worked a little bit, it's like a trendy thing to do. But I'm still going to stick with my gut here, and I'm going to take the pitch. I don't think three or four teams I don't think three or four teams are going to lose 100-plus games. I think the A's are pretty much a lock to lose 100 games. I'm going to put faith in the other three teams. I need two of them to figure it out. The Marlins, in my mind, are not a 100-loss team. I mean, they were a third-place team last year in the NL East, which is a very good division. They surprised people. The injury bug has gotten them big time. The thing is, their start was so bad that even if they course correct a bit here, like, they still may lose 100. But I'm going to count on them a little bit. And I think the Nats or Rockies, one of them will avoid the 100 loss season.
I'm buying it only because I think the Nats won't lose 100 games, but I think the A's, Rockies, and Marlins are all losing 100 games. And look at the pace of the Marlins, are well ahead of that pace. The Rockies, man, we know that if the pitching doesn't work out, they're going to be in trouble because the offense can't keep up with the other teams. And then the A's, I mean, we know what they are. Maybe they get motivated middle of the season at the move. They see the bags starting to be packed, like Sacramento, here we come. And, you know, but I don't know. The A's are, to me, a team that's floundering. So looking at those teams, I'm thinking that we're going to have three of the four losing 100 games. And I think the Nats might be surprising. Sitting at 7-9, I think they could be fun, as you mentioned. They're on the precipice of taking that next step. Maybe not next season, but the year after that.
Yeah, and I think they're going to – sometimes when it's a fun team, the fans show up and the guys feed off that a little bit, overachieve. C.J. Abrams looks like an exciting player, guy who's delivering, really living up to the hype. And you're going to see some other guys come up here, I think, at some point. James Woods, I mean, Jesus, like, that guy looks like he's ready to be here. So, yeah, I think they avoid it. I think they're going to have a fun season at the end. You know, not put up a giant win total, but I think they avoid it.
Well, speaking of the Oakland Athletics of Sacramento, will they increase their payroll significantly as of next year? So to build some context here, Ken Rosenthal of The Athletic cited an anonymous source who stated that the A's plan to ramp up their payroll spending to $130 million or more ahead of the team's move to Las Vegas. So if this is still The Athletics' intention, that would mean that their payroll would be twice as much as it is playing in Sacramento. So there's a lot of, and I went deep into Athletics Twitter and some blogs here to get some feedback of really the meaning behind the sign that was hanging in the Oakland Coliseum all year, which was, quote, Vegas beware. So A's fans doing their best. John Fisher is saying, and this is according to them, on if you go to any Athletic corner of social media, saying that he's the worst owner in sports and it's futile to think he'll ever change. He has no reason to, no matter how much losing or is not tolerated. So do you think they're going to increase because of the shiny bright lights of Las Vegas looming in the future?
All right. So if the statement is that they are going to increase their payroll
significantly
next year, I'm taking the pitch. I am selling. No, I don't buy that at all. And it's deeper than just, I don't think they're going to do it. I also don't know who's going to take their money if they're waving it around. Do you think a lot of established major leaguers want to go play in Sacramento in like the ballpark that they're going to be playing in? No.
Yeah.
I don't think so. So it's more than just like, will they offer or won't they offer? And honestly, putting this out there, I think they know that. I think they know, oh, well, let's just put it out there. We're going to try to spend money. And then we can blame it on, well, we made a bunch of offers. And yeah, well, you chose to play at this ballpark that is not a major league ballpark. And you're already talking about other superstars coming in and hitting home runs against you and being an exciting thing that you can't wait to see. The ownership is a joke. And I don't think there's many guys that are going to want to go play there. So, John Fisher,
if you're looking at incentive to spend money, and we even saw in that press conference talking about exciting moments, and they quoted road players hitting home runs as some of the things they can look forward to. If they're relying on tourism, why would you bother to spend money on your own team when you feel like people are going to be coming into Vegas? Like we said before, the Cirque du Soleil effect of just showing up to the ballpark for what the atmosphere would be. It's not so much what's happening on the field, especially that first year. People just want to come out of sheer curiosity of going to see what baseball is in Vegas. But I think history has shown that it's really just a history of the ownership. And until the ownership changes, no matter the city, it's going to be the same stuff because they're pocketing the money they're not spending.
Yeah. This is just one of those situations where like, you got to hope the ownership changes somewhere in the next 10 years. You got to hope for that. I feel bad for those fans. I really do. Honestly, the Oakland ones, if there are any Sacramento ones, the future Vegas ones, I just feel bad for them.
Yeah. I mean, if you also look at the other logic, is the argument was that he himself, John Fisher, cannot afford to build the ballpark. So he didn't want to have it there, but he's going to be willing to spend money on a team. You know what I mean? Like where's the money coming from? Is it going to be that increase of having, it has to come from somewhere, and it's not coming from people buying the merchandise immediately. There has to be a reason people show up to the ballpark after the intrigue is there. But I don't know if it's going to be incentive, because I feel like Vegas is still a tourism town, and you're going to draw eyes, especially to the ballpark. And we're talking 2 years in advance because they have a couple pit stops to make prior. And we're talking about Sacramento. So even before they get there to be competitive, I don't know if it so much matters if they're good or bad. If they could just be floundering mediocre, that might be the goal. So other teams can come in and beat them up, and you have Yankee fans showing up, Red Sox fans showing up, Met fans, and just going hitting the casino and catching a ball game.
Yeah, I think that's another thing up for debate. Like, when are they actually going to get to Vegas? I feel like that timeline continues to get pushed back. And knowing them, I wouldn't be surprised to see it get pushed back more and more and more. I think it might be
like a National Lampoon's movie of a road trip. Everything's going wrong, and like they just can't make it down the street to Nevada. So, our final buy or sell here is Colton Cowser, and we love Colton Cowser here on this show. And my buy or sell is, could he win a batting title or Rookie of the Year? So technically, right now, Colorado's Ryan McMahon, as of when we put the notes on this morning, was leading the majors in batting average with a mark of .415. Colton Cowser needs more plate appearance to qualify for a batting title. But we know, I mean, he had his brief stint last summer, and you and I were talking about this. Obviously, we didn't have the show, but we were talking about Colton Cowser, how he was really struggling. And we're like, okay, is this not the player that we thought he would be? But we're seeing that player come out here. I mean, he's been very, very good. He's arrived and lived up to every expectation so far of a number 5 overall pick back in 2021. You know, I think this dude is the real deal. And if you're looking at Vegas odds or New York odds, FanDuel odds, as far as Rookie of the Year, everyone's putting a lot of their money on Evan Carter, Wyatt Langford, but you can, and Jackson Holliday, of course. But Colton Cowser is like a sneaky dark horse here. So again, bring it back to the question, batting title or Rookie of the Year? Do you think either one of those things are possible?
Rookie of the Year, yes, I would swing away at that, but I'm being a little bit of a negative Nancy tonight. I'm going to take the pitch as far as batting title. And I mean, he's hitting .405 so far. And here's the thing, like you said, struggled last year when he came up towards the end of the year. Spring tore it up, won a spot on the team, spring training. And then the season started and they weren't giving him everyday playing time. He was kind of being treated like a fourth outfielder. He's forced their hand now where he's in the lineup every night and is going to have to continue to be. Went 2-for-4 tonight. 405 is the batting average as we speak. Two singles tonight. The reason, with all that being said, all that positivity, the reason I'm going to take the pitch on the batting title is just as simple as this is a league where pitchers make adjustments. And all it takes is one or two guys to figure out the hole in your swing or the pitch you can't hit, where then everybody just copies it until you make an adjustment. And then they, you know, you go back to the drawing board. So I think eventually he's due for a big time slump. Or it's a game of baseball, a little injury, that a nagging injury that kind of throws him, you know, off balance a little bit. So I don't know who it is that'll catch him and pass him and how far down the list he'll go. But as far as batting title, I'm going to take that pitch.
And surprising, as stacked as that lineup is, he's been right now the best player in that lineup so far. And that may not last because we know everyone that's in that lineup is star-studded and he may be sitting just being a complimentary player. But right now he's carrying a lion's share of that offense. Again, it's very, very early, but you know, great conversation to have here because the Orioles are just continue to churn out great players, not just prospects. They're good players that are tangibly effective on the Major League Baseball field. And that's amazing. And they seem to be a factory. We call them an electric factory as far as fan base goes, but they're a really good, like all around player. As far as adjustments go for these players, they're Major League ready upon arrival, which is awesome to see. And hopefully Jackson Holliday follows in those footsteps.
Yeah, this topic also made me kind of curious just about batting average or batting title history. So I'm going to throw a random question out to you. If you had to guess what the lowest batting average was for either league to win a batting title in baseball history, what guess would you throw out there?
All right, I mean, if we go back to the dead ball era, are we talking 1969 divisional or are we going all the way back in time?
We can go back baseball history.
I'm going to say lowest, probably for a batting title, 297.
You're not far off. You're not far off. So the National League, it was Tony Gwynn, actually, who won several batting titles. He hit 313 in 1988. And then the lowest of the low was in the AL, and you almost nailed the exact year. Carl Yastrzemski hit 301 in 1968, and he was actually the only guy to hit over 300, which I guess you hit 301 in one batting title. It makes sense. You're the only guy that hit over 300. Right. And one other note I found super interesting. In 1972, Rod Carew won his second batting title without hitting any homers. No home runs.
That's insane.
And he was only the second player ever to do that. Zach Wheat. We all know Zach Wheat, right? In 1918 was the other guy to do it. Good old Zach Wheat. But the Carew thing, I mean, listen, he wasn't a power guy. That wasn't what he was known for. I think 92 career home runs, if I read that earlier. But still, to hit for the batting title and not pop one over the fence, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I love those stats. And, you know, you can lose days on Baseball Reference or FanGraphs just combing through numbers. And they have some tools now where you can actually sit and compare players of bygone eras. And that's the best part. So if you want to lose a day, you know, sit around with friends and talk about baseball stats and quiz each other. But let's get to in honor of Mr. Rose and talk about some of the bets we had last week and what we are fond of this week.
That's Pete Rose! Pete Rose just got tombstone! Pete Rose just got tombstone! And this crowd in Boston loved it!
Every time. Every time.
All right, in honor of Mr. Rose, a bet between both of us, and I'll let you start last week. You had a parlay of the Giants money line on Wednesday versus the Nats, which was Jordan Hicks versus Patrick Corbin, and the Guardians money line versus the White Sox, Tanner Bibee versus Eric Fetty. Parlayed, and you suggested sprinkling a Jose Ramirez home run. And looking at some of it, I mean, not too bad, right? 2 out of 3? 3 out of 4 is that what we're looking at?
Yes, well, so the parlay was just the two money lines, which I hit, and that would have only been plus 115. So it wasn't, you know, I wasn't leaping to some underdog there, but the Guardians needed extra innings to win that game against the White Sox, but Hicks and the Giants took care of business. So I would have hit that one. Jose Ramirez did not pop a home run. There was actually a lot of home runs in that game, but Jose Ramirez was not one of them. I think that was the game, maybe, that both Nailers on National Siblings Day hit home runs, which was pretty cool, but no Jose Ramirez. Do you, should I tell you what I'm going with this week, or do you want to go over yours from last
week? I'll go with my last week because I am kind of proud of it. I did hit 2 of 3 here. Logan Gilbert over 5.5 Ks. He had 8 on the day. Philly's money line over St. Louis on Wednesday. They wind up going over St. Louis 4-3 in a tight-knit game. And just barely missed on this three-part parlay. Texas versus Oakland, they're over on run score. They had 8, and the over-under was 9. So Vegas knows what they're doing, setting that line there. Odds makers are – they win again. That's why they continue to make the money. But better than my normal week, I usually get – I'm usually 0-3, 0-4, so I was pretty happy with that.
It's progress.
So as far as your bet goes for this week, what are you happy with?
Okay, so I'm going to go the first one with Andrew Abbott tomorrow, which tomorrow is Wednesday. We're speaking on Tuesday night right now. They're facing the Mariners. So I haven't seen what the strikeout line is going to be for him yet, but my guess would be maybe over under 4.5 because his strikeout line so far have been 3, 4, and 4. So he has not gone over 4 strikeouts. I don't think they're going to set it at 3.5. The reason I'm going to go over 4.5 here, despite his low strikeout totals so far, is the Mariners have the second worst K percentage. This was a bugaboo for them last year, and it is continuing to be a bugaboo this year. It is kind of one of the big factors that's making them underachieve a bit. 28.2 K percentage as a team, which is second worst in the majors, only to the magnificent Oakland Sacramento Athletics. So I'll go with that. And then the other one I'm going to go with, and I think I'm going to keep them separate. I don't think I'm going to parlay them. I'm going to try to be smart for 1 week here. I'll take the Cardinals money line versus Oakland, which might sound obvious, but Cardinals are facing Paul Blackburn, who has been fantastic. I do not think he's given up a run yet. Oakland is probably drooling at the thought of trading him away in a couple months. Oakland has a 32.1% K rate as a team versus left-handed pitching. Steven Matz is a left-handed pitcher. They also have a 28% K rate against right-handed pitchers, but that, 3% is significant. So you could also play the K number for Matz, whatever that may be, to go over, I guess, in that position too. But I think the Cardinals take the money line over Oakland. So those are my two for this week.
So on my end here, I have the Astros money line over the Braves. Looking at the, and I feel even more confident now that the Astros are down, and I just like to play those, evening it out, especially as a day game approaching on Wednesday. Max Fried pitching for the Braves. We know he struggled. We talked about that last week. And JP France has not been good either for the Astros, but I can foresee the Astros offense carrying them over to have them win this game outright. And then Marcus Stroman over 5.5 Ks. I like that against Toronto tomorrow. And then, when I made this, Twins and Orioles opened their series tonight, where they popped off offensively. 11-3 was they blew past the over. I have them under for tomorrow during a day game. And that my thinking was a little bit weary after a night game. I think they're going to start to, feel a certain way. I think I don't know the analytics behind it, but I think runs scored on a day after a night game tends to be there. And I'm going to go with my gut there. So I'm going to do Astros money line and Braves. Astros money line versus the Braves is Stroman 5.5 Ks as a parlay. And then the run scored under with the Twins and Orioles as a separate bet. So that's what I'm feeling this week.
I'm going to say you'll go two for three again on those.
you think Twins and Orioles are going over?
After tonight, it's hard not to. The other thing I'm not sure of is Astros against the Braves.
Right now. I can't find it on FanDuel.
Yeah.
My guess is that based on, and again, this might work in my favor, based on tonight, the line might have jumped up a couple runs, maybe 2 or 3 runs because of what we saw tonight. So I guess it depends. So
I had a question. This is not something we plan on talking about, but I'm watching MLB Network's kind of 4 split screen right now, and I saw Luis Guillorme, former Mets great, up at the plate. I'm guessing he's going to get more at bats now with Ozzie Albies down. But you might have seen the other night when the Mets blew out the Braves, which was wonderful to see. Usually we're on the other end of that. Luis Guillorme pitched for the Braves, kind of just, not wanting to waste another arm. And it was his first appearance, a position player. It was his first appearance in a Braves uniform, the first playing time he got this season. I would like to know, and I wish I thought about this before we came on here. I want to know if any other position player has ever made his team debut on the mound. Because that seemed like something we talked about the Skorigami before. Like that
yeah.
happens.
I would imagine that maybe way back in the day, like if you just had these, like, you know, when everyone used to, players working at the grocery store prior to coming out to the ballpark, like we're talking like 1919, that might have happened. But as far as current day, can you imagine? I can't see that happening. Guess what? Suit up, you're on the team, but I know you're second baseman, but you know, it's a blowout. Go mop this shit up.
It's crazy, but you're probably right. 1915, like Bob from accounting, who's supposed to play shortstop, gets thrown on the mound last second.
Exactly. The other thing I want to mention, and again, we didn't put it in our news, but it did pop into my radar during the day, but former Mariners Royal shortstop Unisky Betancourt was arrested for allegedly staging a car crash to collect insurance.
Oh,
so
shit.
He's facing jail time. He hasn't played in the league since 2013, but he's one of four people who have been arrested and charged with insurance fraud for allegedly staging a car crash in Miami in order to collect the payout. So according to the police, Betancourt, Vera Pena, and Perez reported they were involved in a car crash on December 6, 2022 to the police and their insurance company, Kemper Insurance. The investigations revealed the accident never took place, even though all four individuals purposely sought treatment and physical therapy for injuries they never sustained. Kemper Insurance was billed over $61,000 from two different clinics and also paid out $22,800 therapy billing. So you don't got the money, dude. I mean, Betancourt made over $16 million over in your career, and you're going to jail over $22,000 with insurance fraud. What's going on, dude?
That should have been our opening say. We should have gone with that. That would have just locked people into this episode.
I just don't understand. I mean, the name, I mean, there was another Betancourt that played in baseball, right? This is a few of them, but
I think there've been a few. Yeah.
Yeah. But Unisky is going to be facing jail time, and you know, you don't want to mess with the insurance fraud. They'll catch you, dude.
I mean, he's trying to hustle, man.
Well, I mean, you made $16 million during your career, bro. Like, what are we doing?
Never enough. Inflation.
Yeah, exactly. It's inflation. But let's get to our minor issue here and talk about an exciting prospect, one that is on our minds right now. All right, Devin, lead us through here. We have a prospect that, you know, we were discussing who to showcase here and have conversations about their numbers and what they've been doing. Last week, we did a lesser known prospect. This one's a little bit more of a well-known prospect if you're following the draft pools as far as deeper prospect leagues.
Yeah, this is such a hard decision each week, like who to profile. There's so many guys to choose from. The prospect coverage is so great nowadays. Like, you really can know so much about so many different dudes. We decided, and this was put on my radar because of the Seiya Suzuki injury, because I saw some people in the comments saying, oh, is it Owen Casey time? And it's not. But Owen Casey's our guy, Cubs prospect, one of many high-profile Chicago Cubs prospects. I had one article I was reading that someone comparing it to kind of the guys that ended up coming up to the, you know, form the 2016 team eventually. That kind of excitement when you look at this hall of prospects they have going right now. So Casey is a corner outfielder, most likely, lefty Canadian kid. So far on the season, he's hitting .245, .373 on base. He's walking 15% of the time, which I think that's important because of the next number I'm going to give you. The biggest knock on him is his K rate. Strikes out about anywhere between 30 and 35% of the time consistently. If you look at that number across the board season by season, that's where he is. He's at 32% right now. Hasn't popped a home run in the regular season in the minors yet, but he's a guy with pure power. That is what people are excited about. He's got a lot of natural pop. If you look at spring training, he was with the major league squad for the majority of spring training. He hung around for a long time. He ended up hitting .333 through spring, .973 OPS, pretty nice, almost over 1,000 there. Two home runs, 11 RBIs, and 39 at-bats. Did strike out 13 times, so there is that 30% or over K rate. That's, again, consistent. I don't think that's going to change very much, at least. But he's a guy you're wondering when. The time is not now. Some people were hoping it was now with the Suzuki injury. But at least right this second, it seems like they want him to get more reps in AAA. But this is a guy I think the Cubs expect to be a main part of their team in the future.
Yeah, and as you said before, the Padres deal with Yu Darvish, acquiring him was a big piece to why they were able to let Darvish go. And,
yep,
you know, I think this guy's 6'4", 190 pounds. Like, this is a big dude. He's probably going to grow more into the frame as he gets older. He's got power potential from the left side. People are very excited about the exit velocity that they're seeing at the Super 60 Showcase. Just the raw power. A lot to be excited about as far as that. And like you said, opening up with Seiya Suzuki being hurt, felt like he would be next man up, but maybe they need more seasoning happening. But looking at some of the numbers, spring training and also this season so far, it feels like he's ready. Especially, again, we're looking at a team, and I know they're being competitive early in the season. Cubs really have nothing to lose by letting some of these players go out there and showcase what they can do on the big league level. Because they're, as we know, it's one thing to be in AAA. It's another thing to be at Wrigley Field in front of those bright lights and those fans. I would like to see what he can do sometime this season. Is it going to happen next month? No, but maybe it's sometime in July we get to see him and start to get to know his name.
Yeah, so this was the article I was kind of alluding to before. The title was Loaded Cubs Farm Has New Director, Similar Vibe to Past Glory, written by Jonathan Mayo on MLB.com. They talk about a few players, including Matt Shaw, and then Owen Casey is listed as the camp standout. This was written back in, I think, mid-March, so it's, spring was not done yet, but just a little bit I'll read here. It says, Casey might have as much raw power as just about any prospect in the game currently. And in 2023, he started getting to it more consistently, hitting 22 homers and 31 doubles with Double A, while turning just 21 years old midseason last year. 519 slugging percentage seems like just the beginning. And though some might be concerned with his 31.1% strikeout rate last year, he offset it with a robust 14.4% walk rate. I think that's just a good point. There's a lot of guys nowadays that strike out around 30% of the time, let's be honest. And there's some of those guys never sniff a walk. And now this year he's following that 14.4% rate with a 15% rate so far. So consistent. He's very consistent in what he does. And if you know what you're getting and you can count on it, I think you can figure out how to use that to your advantage.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting to see what happens. As I mentioned before, we know when the weather gets warmer in Chicago, those fans turn out, take their shirts off, drink a lot of beer, and Owen Casey may be a part of that celebration, hitting home runs out in Wrigley Field. And as we know, is the raw power. So could be seeing it sooner than later. Hopefully Seiya Suzuki is not going to be out for the long haul like we saw last year. It just seemed like a never-ending oblique injury that just never healed. So maybe it's a blessing if Owen Casey does not have to come up. But if Seiya Suzuki's not coming back, I mean, who better than Owen Casey to take his spot? So like what we're seeing from him as far as potential. But let's come around third here and kind of wrap up what's going on and give our preview of what we're excited for next week. All right, as we wrap up this episode, first of all, we want to appreciate you guys listening to what we're doing here. And again, follow us on Instagram at TableSettersPod, also on Twitter. Support the show. Join the conversation. We'll be here for the long haul, covering all 162 games plus October. So we're going to be covering all those games and beyond and having conversations in the offseason. This is going to be a long haul. Devin and I are participating in this passion project we've been trying to do for a long time. But as far as previewing for next week, looking at some of the stuff, I'm going to stick with the New York perspective. I like the two weekend series both happening for the Mets and the Yankees. Mets, of course, taking on the Dodgers, and the Yankees, believe it or not, in a battle for first place after coming off to a hot start. The Rays have been keeping up pace here, only two games back for the Yankees as we speak, for first place. So big test for both teams. Highly touted. We know the Rays and Yanks always play each other tooth and nail. There's been recent playoff history between the Mets and the Dodgers, and just it's a big test, a barometer of what the Mets have overcome. And we know they've played some tough games, and they've played the Braves, and we've seen them in tight fits against good offenses, but none better than the Dodgers. And for them to go into Dodger Stadium, I'm curious to see what the boys in Queens can do.
Yeah, I'll, obviously, as a Mets fan, I'll be watching that closely too. And honestly, the Yankees too, they're interesting to me. It's such a hot start. A little bit of trouble these last few games. Did they lose tonight? Is that game still going?
They came back, scored a run in the ninth, and then fell short 5-4. So they dropped the game tonight, two in a row now.
Okay, so like you, as a Yankee fan, you're still pretty happy with where they are, but you want to see them avoid a super long losing streak here and kind of get back, especially against division foes. And like you said, that division, even with that hot start, the Orioles right on their tail. Everybody seems to be right on their tail. So, you know, they still have tons and tons of work to do. That's a great division, honestly.
Well, if they lose three straight to the Tampa Bay Rays, the sky is kind of going to be falling on New York sports radio. So
yeah, that's how quickly it can happen.
Weird pressure on this series where you went in sky high when they're sitting at, you know, 7 games over .500. You're feeling, okay, they're invincible. But as we know, baseball's a marathon and ebbs and flows. As you said before, the Mets faced that adversity early in the season, but every single team, even those the best teams in the history of baseball, 98 Yankees, there are losing streaks that happen, that whether due to injury or just slumps, it's going to happen. And it builds character for these teams. So the Yankees are already playing a big series against Tampa Bay this weekend. And it's going to be a test for them.
Yeah. And I mean, we know the offense looks better. You know, we know they're dogs, right? They seem to have fun playing together. But if you step back and look at it, I still think you should be concerned with the pitching staff until Gerrit Cole comes back being kind of paper thin, and the bullpen. I think the bullpen is a legitimate concern. So those are things to look out for. For me, looking outside of New York, I put down two series on the weekend. I think one is Rangers Braves. You got the World Series champs, loaded offense. They're basically off to a .500 start. Nothing special, but no one in that division really seems to be putting it all together right now in the AL West. So Rangers Braves, I think that's a lot of fun. Potential World Series preview. Wouldn't be the biggest shock in the world. And both a little banged up. So we'll see who can fight through the injuries. And then the other one, this just happened about a week or week and a half ago, Orioles Royals. I think when they met up about a week or two ago, no one was buying the Royals yet. And then they kind of hung with the Orioles. I think they blew one late lead in a Cole Reagan start, but kind of hung with them in that series. So we'll see what series number two between those two teams looks like. Both a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, I mean, we could be looking at an ALCS preview if that's a pipe dream for everybody. But all joking aside, I think these are a lot of – all four of those teams you mentioned are good young talent. They're firing on all cylinders. And like you mentioned, the Rangers are – a little bit underwhelming to start the season, but as you mentioned, the AL West is not pulling away. Of course, the Astros struggling and a test against the Braves. If we are lucky enough, even speaking objectively as a baseball, to get the Texas Rangers versus the Atlanta Braves in some capacity in the World Series, I mean, as a Yankee fan, I'd rather the Yanks be there, so the Rangers, but just for sheer entertainment of two great lineups, I mean, how that would be a dream come true for Rob Manfred in baseball.
Yeah, not bad at all. Just an update on a couple of things. Michael Busch is 0-for-2 so far as we prepare to say bye. So who knows in the morning if it's a different story. But that streak might be coming to an end. And then Forrest Whitley just got through his first inning of work in relief for the Houston Astros, trying to clean some stuff up as the Braves.
Interesting, he's coming out of the bullpen. I think that wasn't specified, but I guess it makes sense that he wouldn't be coming right into the rotation, especially with uneasy footing.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if you look back, Ben Brown was called up by the Cubs like a week or two ago, and I thought it was as a starter. I picked him up in fantasy right away, and then all of a sudden he was in on relief, kind of getting crushed. But then his next outing was a start. So maybe they're just breaking him in here, and maybe they'll give him a start sometime next week.
So that's all we got for you guys today. We appreciate you listening. If you did like what you listened to, please leave a 5-star review, interact with us, send us an email. It's in our bio on Instagram at TableSettersPod, also on Twitter at TableSettersPod, whatever is your choosing. Talk to us, ask us some questions, have some conversations, engage with the Reels, trying to build this from the ground up. We appreciate all the support, all the great interactions we've had thus far. Let's build the baseball community about talking all the great stuff in baseball, trying to build upon what we're talking about here. But that's all we got for you again, and we will talk to you next week for episode 6, believe it or not, breaking down all the action MLB, all the breaking news, all the conversation and conjecture that you love here. But we'll talk to you guys after a while.